Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winna Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hi, Guy. I like your sweater vest game today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's the rare season in Los Angeles when I can layer without sweating profusely, so I'm doing it.
But it was like 80 today, though.
Really? I don't know. I'm in an office all day long. I barely pay attention. Every week, we start the show by taking a question from our listeners about our own pop culture taste. This week, I want you guys to tell me, what song do you always skip on an album you otherwise love? The person said, I'm going with Shiny Happy People, hashtag ever skip. They're trying to create branded hashtags on our show. I appreciate your valiant effort, but I just wanted to make clear that it wasn't me because I can't, how different we are as people, you, whoever this person is, and me, all I want to listen to from what are they called? Those people.
E52? Or REM?
REM.
Yeah.
All I want to listen to is Stand and Shiny Happy People. I have no time for anything
one
of the rest
person
of the year.
Skip is another treasure.
Mm-hmm.
But Winner, what do you always skip?
One album that I love is Post by Bjork. I think I've mentioned it before. Mm. It's one of my first albums I can listen to beginning to end on my own volition. And the only track on that album that I didn't like as much as every other track was Cover Me. And it's just a really slow, like her kind of like whispering and, you know, doing her little Icelandic thing. But it didn't, that one didn't resonate with me as much as all of the other songs, which is always awkward that I have to skip over one song out of 12.
Understandable. Margaret?
There's this Vampire Weekend album, Contra, that I got really into, I don't know, 4 or 5 summers ago. It's a perfect summer record, but there's a song on there called California English that's just a travesty of auto-tune and bad reggae. And every time it comes on, I'm just, like, filled with hate. Like, it's almost a physical, visceral reaction.
Nice. What about you, Oliver?
Well, funny enough, I was just writing about this earlier in the week because I've been reviewing the reissue of Tribe Called Quest's debut album, which celebrates its 25th year. People's instinctive travels and paths of rhythm. And one of the things I was remembering is because I first heard the album on cassette, I never liked the last song on the A side, which is a song called Pubic Enemy, which I always thought was a much better pun than it was an actual song. And the first song on side B was Benita Applebaum. So every time I would get around to the point where Pubic Enemy starts, instant fast forward and just to get to the other side of the tape. So that'd be it.
I have really no answer for this question. The thing is the number of albums that I listen to straight through is very, very limited. And those really are your Alanis Morissette, your Spice Girls. I mean, just situations where, like, I want, you know. Every track is winning. it is very unusual. But I will note that in the song I Kissed a Girl by Katy Perry, there is a point where the audio goes back and forth between your ears. And I will always skip ahead past that because it makes me sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
So thanks to Jay Withy in the Max One Reddits for that question, though you were wrong about REM. Coming up in this week's show, we're going to talk about Chirac. For the second time, we officially went to a movie as a family, except that I did not show up. So we've got our thoughts. And we're going to talk about the movie. We're going to go like full bore at the movie. So if you are concerned about spoilers, don't listen to that section and go see the movie. And if you aren't concerned about spoilers, enjoy our thoughts. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver Wang. What's your jam? What are you all about?
What am I all about? I'm all about two things. The return of Top Chef. This would have been more apropos to talk about during our cooking show episode, but this...
We couldn't get our shit together and figure out when Top Chef started.
It's fine. It's much later. I love the fact they are celebrating 10 years of Top Chef, which it feels like it should be like 20 years, but it's only been 10 years. And they've come back to California, and it's not just L.A., but they're actually doing different installments in different cities in L.A. Sorry, in California, I mean. So it's a very West Coast-centric one. And even just in the first two episodes, everything that I love about how well made the show is, the characters, the challenges, et cetera, are all on full display. So I am completely back in with Top Chef. And a very small about around Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I've only seen one episode, but I really owe it an apology because I assumed it was a shitty show just based on what I thought was a really bad title. And I still think it's a bad title, but it's got a show where there's a musical number about Wes Covina. Like, I'm not gonna say no to that on general principle.
Those are both shows that I like need to get on. I need to get on right now.
I've seen a few episodes of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and yeah, I also feel like from that episode where we all bagged on it prematurely, we owe an apology and a collective apology.
I think that would be you guys who bagged on it.
No, honey, you were right there with
was
us.
Was I?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was drunk.
Margaret, what are you all about?
I'm all about the New York Times front page editorial. The reason I'm all about this is because it was such a crazy week as far as the media went in covering the San Bernardino shootings and just the whole gun control, terrorism, you know, just nexus in general. And there were some really, I think, huge missteps done in the news. Like, for instance, the whole thing of going into the Farouk apartment and pawing through, having the journalists paw through, you know, baby toys and their toothbrushes and their Quaker Oats or whatever, trying to figure out if any of these things were signs of their terrorism. And it just felt absurd and petty. And I was really feeling down about that. Like, I just felt like, oh, we're just in a really gross moment of covering this kind of thing. And then, boom, the New York Times just drops this eloquent front page editorial that was just stark and smart and just cut to the core of the argument. And it's the kind of argument that, like, it was beautifully presented because it's the public is with this argument. You know what I mean? This is the kind of thing where we've done study after poll after study, and this is the way the public feels by and large. So it just cut through all the bullshit around that whole thing.
Yeah. There is something so interesting about after having a good 20 years of tabloid television news, having people finally hit that point where things have scraped so low that we're having to step back and say, wait a minute, why are we doing this? And having the New York Times come out in a clear, bold way and say, this is sort of what we're going to talk about in the main section of the show, but just sort of trying to look at things in a new way because we just haven't been doing anything about them.
And I want to just say, too, that it was the first one since 1920, which I think has to be mentioned. And I was like, what was the one in 1920? And it was about Warren Harding.
Oh, my God.
I do think it raises a question as to why didn't the New York Times break this policy for so many other issues prior to this? And again, I'm not giving them a hard time about it, but I think once you kind of breach this self-imposed rule, then there is a natural question, which is, so why this issue and not the other things that why weren't those considered, you know, breachable? You know,
the reason I think so is because that shows you what overwhelming support that has. Mm-hmm. Because every time there's something on A1, that has to be decided amongst like 20 plus people. And you're talking about people who are conservative. You're talking about people who are liberal. You're talking about people who stand on every which way on the issues. And so you don't get a lot of consensus on issues. And so I think this is just such a wellspring of feeling and emotion and sensibility about this that it was like, we're unanimous. Put this on the front page.
Well, also the concept that we do need to, what we're doing isn't working.
Yeah.
Is interesting. There was, I think it was Split Setter. I don't remember exactly where, but it was a comedy review site. Maybe it was Vulture. That was basically a little bit critical of Trevor Noah, saying that he's doing political criticism and satire of the sort we've seen, but it's of the sort we've seen, and that it needs to go deeper because as it is, just sort of saying, haha, they're silly, isn't doing anything. And I think with the sheer number of shootings that we've had and the inability to get Congress to pass a law to say people who are on no-fly lists shouldn't be able to buy assault weapons, it really is an interesting moment where we need to step back and start.
And like when many members of the NRA themselves want more gun control.
Yeah.
I mean, this is when it just goes into complete lunacy.
Can we just give credit to New York Daily News because they have gone balls to the walls with their covers on this?
They
certainly
have.
I don't
want to
give them all that credit that just that quick. The ones I want to really give credit to, I really want to give credit to the San Bernardino Police Department. Just in watching and exhibiting just sort of, we live in a society where, especially in Los Angeles, we always have them breaking into the news and showing us somebody's careening down a freeway and how is this going to end up, right? So it wasn't unusual to have my news broken into, but what was unusual was showing how effective they were in communicating information and giving us details throughout the entirety of it. And you watch that in comparison to other scenarios where the police are speaking on behalf of the community and, you know, Ferguson, Baltimore, and it just looks like it's havoc is happening behind them. These guys were cool as a cucumber, presented facts, always said that they don't want to speculate on anything. This is basically what they know now. And I found, I mean, there's always sort of like this need to like hammer on policemen. But I think they did an amazing job keeping as many people alive as they could and then getting to these guys before it got too, before it was too late.
Reality TV has made everyone better at media.
Yes.
I mean,
true.
Yeah. Winner, what are you all about this week?
James Dean, not the legend.
Different legend.
Different legend.
D-E-E-N.
D-E-E-N. D-E-E. Whatever. It doesn't matter. You're out. He's a porn star, and he's assaulted and raped women. And I don't know how many people know him. He's done.
And he was, for a long time, he was like the...
He was the feminist, baby-faced Jewish boy next door.
Yeah, and he was in the canyons with Lindsay, and he was doing a column for the Frisky. And now we find out from Stoya, the other porn star, that he's raped her and he's assaulted her. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this week that I was all about is because...
And for both of these things, these are just accusations that have not been proven in
court.
Right,
exactly.
But also many...
Allegedly.
Right. This is all an allegedly, but we all also understand that rape and sexual assault are things that very frequently get unspoken and are not pursued in the criminally in the way that they should be. And
sure.
So, you know, we respect these accusations.
Of course.
And other women have come out to confirm that Stoya was, not just her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reason why I was all about it is because I was sort of, my friend Amelia was the editor-in-chief of Frisky. She's stepped down, but she's the one who sort of launched this column with him. And I never had an opinion about him because I don't really care about male porn stars. I'm one of those weird women who just enjoys porn to just see women being treated like they're the most beautiful thing in the world. And I'm sex positive. But the thing that I find interesting is that I'm annoyed that these women couldn't stand on their own testament. Like, they couldn't stand on it without people immediately attacking them for being porn stars and like, don't you like that? And I guess I'm basically saying is I don't care what these young people are seeing now. Porn was never really like that. Porn was sold as like narrative and like sensuality and seduction. All this hardcore ball slapping is a product of like this new generation. So I'm kind of actually glad whether it's true, then yes. I am apologetic if it's not true. But if it is true, I'm glad that he's being singled out for this because I'm so tired of this era of aggressive sex on camera. And then young men think this is what women like. All women don't like that. And I also don't like the idea that these women weren't trusted to be able to say, I didn't want to do that. They made me do it anyway. There's so much conflict and weirdness in that industry, and people don't treat it like it is also to an industry with job, with pay, with benefits, all other stuff. And I just have to, like, defend these women.
There is a comic in New York. I forget her name.
I like when you low talk shade.
She has she's the best joke. She's talking about porn for women, and what she says the best porn for women would be, like, the guy comes, they yell cut, and then you pull out, and you see her walk and be treated with respect by the director, go get a paycheck, get safely to her car, check her mirrors, and then the movie's over. things like this do really make me sad because there are a lot of people out there, especially a lot of feminists who are very strongly of the opinion that any and all sex work is necessarily compromising mm-hmm. and necessarily exploitative and necessarily terrible. And as somebody who has long said, hey, the magnificent world of porn and sex work for gay men don't hurt no women, almost definitively. And like that, honestly, in a game where you do have players with equal mm-hmm. power socially, mm-hmm. things do turn out differently. And it makes me very sad for women who are employed in porn or sex work who enjoy the work that they do right. and who are proud of the work that they do, that we necessarily must, like, the notion that all of that work is bad also contributes to people not being able to speak up about something like this mm-hmm. without being questioned mm-hmm. and impugned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you really touch on the layer that I want to add to this, which is that people who, anti-porn activists, they jump on any negative stories coming out of it. And
right.
so even though it's important to sort of potentially expose, you know, an alleged rapist, on the flip side, I think people are also hesitant in terms of how this gives ammunition to sort of anti-porn crusaders. It's a point to look how bad this is. You're employing a rapist. And so, it just becomes much more complicated in these kinds of situations
right.
because of the embattlement that you're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Well, so James Dean. Apparently
he's
going to
go work at a 7-Eleven.
Let me add one small thing to this. I did interview James Dean like about 4 years ago.
Tell us everything.
And he lives in exactly the kind of house in the valley that you think he lives in.
What is it, though?
Like, it is just the cheesiest, emptiest marble palace of, like, you know, there's like a video game console and like a dirty black leather couch and like sweat socks on the couch. And like, and then like the kitchen is like nice, but there's not. Like, it just had no life in there. It just had that, like, cold, gross, like, dead-eyed valley feeling, you know? Not there's lovely places in the valley. I do not mean to hate on the valley.
Nice.
But it was just, I mean, and when I met him, you know, and part of the reason I even did this interview is for Rolling Stone, and part of the reason I even did it is because he did have this reputation mm-hmm. as this feminist, and I was, like, kind of interested in what he would say. But, you know, and he seemed fine. He seemed like a nice guy. That means nothing either way about these accusations. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like he was mechanical about his work in the worst way. You know what I mean? Like, talking to him about why he was in it and what he thought about it, I just felt like...
Really canned responses, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but just also, like, not feeling. Like, just not emotionally invested in it in this way that felt to me just intuitively, like, a little gross, you know?
Well,
and I've talked to other people in sex work, and that's not always the case, you know?
Right.
But I, really fast, I've met a lot of porn stars, and... For some reason, there's always this initial guard up because they're wondering if you're judging them.
Right.
And then I always break it down by saying, like, I watch porn. I love porn. Like, I have no problem with it at all. And then they sort of bring that demeanor down. But I think they're always walking with, like, this guard that someone's going to immediately, like, you know, Westboro them in the middle of the street. And the reality is... more people than you know are actually watching you doing what you do and enjoy it. I just wish there wasn't, like, this sort of shame.
I just,
it.
Like, you know, coming from the perspective of gay guy and, like, the way that I just understand closetedness, like, us wanting to shit on industries that we all participate in is, like...
ridiculous.
Fuck that. What are you... Like, you're messing up your own brain and... participating in the messing up of other people's brains when you look down on people for doing a thing that you pay for and you watch. And I just wish we could all be a little bit more, you know, in the same room with it.
Do you really think this is going to impede Dean's career?
He's already lost a lot of
I mean, like,
contracts. And...
he's going to have to take a step away and, like, try to go mainstream. And I don't
and that's
really...
not going
to
work. Why
well,
would they take him?
I don't give a shit about what ends up happening to him because he may or may not have assaulted a woman, but I believe a woman first. But to me, like what Guy said, it's basically the same thing like picketing Taco Bell all day long and then, like, gorging on gorditas at night. It doesn't make sense to go and, like, put a public face on something that you're so abjectly against and then, like, turn around and, like, just be satisfied by it. It's so weird.
What's so funny is I don't like people talking shit about porn and, like, many of the ways that people would be like, oh, porn leads
right.
to this. But I do think, like, too much of a media sensation about how somebody is one of the good ones is always
going to
setting
things
up.
Yeah, it's always like a faulty narrative.
Like
on
Jenna
travel.
Jameson, like Brie Olson.
I mean, just sort of like anytime somebody is telling you how much of a feminist a dude is,
ugh,
anytime some straight
right
person, you're finding out how much of an ally they are,
mm-hmm.
there's going to come a point in time when even when it's something as little as Cate Blanchett, and the Carol bullshit.
It always comes out. Money over everything.
And the thing is Cate Blanchett didn't do anything terrible. She's just not a gay person.
Right.
You know? All right. This week, I am all about a podcast. And the worst part about it is Maximum Fun also does a podcast of the genre, and it's not the one that I have fallen in love with. I recently, Blaine Capadge, a very funny comedian who writes for At Midnight, tweeted that they were going to be ending his podcast, or a podcast that he's on, called Nerd Poker. And I was like, Nerd Poker? What is, I mean, Nerd Poker would be Dungeons and Dragons. And yeah, it's a 153-episode long Dungeons and Dragons game that is him, Brian Posehn, another great comic from the 90s, well, who's still around today and was on the Sarah Silverman program, but I first became aware of him in the 90s. Two guys who used to work with me at G4, one of them, like, their dungeon master was my PA. And I, like, totally knew that he was, like, dungeon master to the stars, but I never realized.
That, why can't that be my second career?
That there was, like, a podcast about it.
It could be.
It could be.
And then an actor and one girl, because it's a Dungeons & Dragons game, and they have to have one girl who is more sensible than the rest of them combined. And it's just, I mean, delightful to listen to. I say this as we're making a podcast, but I feel like with a podcast, you want this very particular level of engagement.
Right.
That is a little bit like, I can do this while I'm doing something else and
sure.
zone out a little bit and it's fine.
Like Real Housewives.
Yes. Or us. but it's really fun. And there's also something so funny about the fact that every time I've been in a Dungeons & Dragons game, there have been a bunch of gay guys in a Dungeons & Dragons game. And, like, listening to one that is, like, guys in their 40s, like, some of whom have kids and stuff, is just so funny because there are those fart jokes and the things that they think are gross. But it's very, very funny people, like, having adolescent nerd fun. And it's just one of the most satisfying things. So please enjoy some Nerd Poker. And then also you should probably check out the Maximum Fun Dungeons & Dragons podcast that is called something. I don't know.
Oh,
what,
wow.
What a great tack on afterthought there, guy. That's...
What is it called? It's called The Adventure Zone.
Wow.
And it stars those dudes from My Brother and Me, whom I have never met. All right.
Hey, guys.
You guys are listening to Pop.
Maximum Fun.
What's up, fam? All right.
Maximum Fun. Team Internet. We support the Internet. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Chirac after this.
Hi, I'm Lisa Hanawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller. And if you're not listening to our podcast, Baby Geniuses, you're missing out on stuff like...
Kumail Nanjiani solving the Zodiac murders.
Who's like... Would you ever go to a friend and you're like, hey, could you... Lick all these envelopes for me. You'd be like, you're a serial killer. I'm leaving right now.
Guy Branum talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And it was just a great moment of like, oh no, I'm here, boys. Like, I'm on this side of the bench.
Megan Amram talking about intimidating baristas.
Just feel like they're always in character. Like, they're always in character as, like, cool hipster girl. Mm-hmm. And I just want to break through that barrier.
Plus, every week we explore a new Wikipedia page and talk to a crazy expert in the field of nonsense.
Well, any hack can make you not have a boner. I mean, it's about how you do it.
Right.
You
know?
And we're the only podcast with regular updates about Martha Stewart's pony or your money back.
We're not going to give them their money back, are we?
No.
Let's keep it.
Yeah.
Listen to our show every other Monday on Maximum Fun.
Yay!
Yay!
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
Now, Oliver, if you were to synopsize Chirac, how would you do that?
Well, the film is it's a remake, or it riffs on an ancient Greek play about a group of women who go on strike sex-wise in order to stop the warring states of, between what the Spartans and the Greeks.
And the Athenians, they're both Greeks.
Okay, whatever. I've never read the original, but they go on a sex strike to stop the men from fighting. And so what Spike Lee, who directs Chirac, is doing is he's applying this same story to Southside Chicago, which has been suffering from rampant gun violence for years now. Largely within the black community. And so the idea here is that a group of African-American women decide to lead a sex strike in order to stop the gang violence happening in this area.
And it's all in rhyming verse.
It's not, though.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
most of it is.
But...
it's a little, it's kind of arbitrary. Like, they kind of decide when to do it and when not to do it. Okay. They're not fully committed.
I couldn't quite tell if it, because there were periods of time when it really felt like verse, when it felt metrically sound.
Yes.
And then there were periods when it just felt like they were rhyming a lot.
Yes.
When it felt tacky and gross. But those moments when, you know, because this is a very serious problem that we deal with in film in a usually very real way. Where, you know, boys in the hood, lovely young men who had a future ahead of him get shot down in the streets. And we have crying mothers and real, real emotion. And there was something so wonderful about the fact that this movie laid over that, this structure and this weird, dark satire, because it did sort of force you to look at these facts and these narratives in a different way. There, at times, it was so lovely to have that verse give Shakespearean moment to this story.
Yes, it did. I think it was beautiful and poetic to sort of apply that narrative to this whole theme. Like, and what was more startling, I think, it was to be able to watch it and know that this has been going on for so long. Nothing has changed, but this was the only thing that bothered me about it completely was like, this was the idea. They were going to withhold sex, which is so, I felt like people were being just like objectified. Like, I felt this is the grand idea.
There've been a fair number of people. And look, Liz Estrada has always been, it's always been a question of, is this reductionist or is it feminist?
Sure.
Like, is it just saying women have nothing more to offer than their vaginas? The thing is, it's Aristophanes. This is a dude who's throwing up two big middle fingers at everybody he's talking to.
Yeah, I mean, that play has literally been pissing people off since it first was performed in 500 BC.
And it's supposed to.
Yeah, exactly.
It's supposed to.
That's the mechanism.
And what's so funny is, like, instead of a Greek chorus, there is Samuel L. Jackson showing up singularly to sort of, like, keep things going along. But in Aristophanes' day, it was normal for the playwright himself to sort of come out and just talk shit about people in the audience.
Which I kind of love.
Like, I love Lysistrata, and I love just about every, like, fringe festival reinterpretation of Lysistrata, because God knows there have been thousands of them. But this idea of just, like, there's something so stupid and Gilbert and Sullivan about, like, this is the way we're going to solve this problem.
But he never makes that case. He never says this is going to solve the problem.
Right.
He has in interviews. He has said, I quote, this film will save lives.
Yeah, but he's also, like, on a promotional tour. I don't really think he's sitting there thinking that this movie is going to actually... I mean, no, nothing can change this issue. That's what I think the point of the movie actually is that it is so albatross at this point, and there has been the earnest delivery of the issue, I mean, which Spike himself has made, like, for little girls, you know? Like, he's been that guy that's made the most, like, somber, sober version of the story.
Right.
But he also is now just flipping it over to, like, here is this absurdist way of looking at this. Here's the Doctor Strangelove way of looking at this. You know, where it's like, this is war. This is about war. Mm-hmm. And, like, war, like, doesn't stop, you know? And sometimes all you can do is, like, gallows humor. All you can do is, like, is laugh, because or else you'll cry.
And the thing is people talking about it and people saying, oh, it's stupid to apply this thing to the story, is, like, I think kind of missing the glory of the original, which is, it was an interminable war that did destroy both countries, essentially.
Right.
And he was just sort of making a hilarious joke about, well, we could have just stopped this. Like, we could have just stopped this, and we didn't. And isn't that ridiculous? Which, you know, I think I like gallows humor.
But the end of the film suggests that they do solve it. So whether or not Spike Lee really intends us to think that this is, I mean, the film is not meant to be a template, a blueprint for how you stop gang violence in the South Side of Chicago.
Right.
But the narrative of the film, what there is of it, suggests that he's saying that this is a way out, and here it is. If you wanted to undermine it by making the point that you're saying he's making, that this is intractable, I did not get that from the film.
And gentle listener, please do not be mistaken in thinking that me liking this movie means I think it is a good movie. It is a shit show. But it is a fascinating shit show. And this movie did so much to make me look at things that I'm used to looking at and actually see them in a way that I don't. The language, the ridiculousness, the having alongside each other these very, very, like, pathos-riddled stories. Like, Jennifer Hudson is essentially just crying for a dead child the entire time.
Yeah.
You have Angela Bassett showing up and Angela Bassetting at you really, really hard in a way that we don't get enough, alongside these sort of like candy-colored constructions of the heads of the two gangs. And also the weirdness of, like, one of them is Nick Cannon, who is great. One of them is Wesley Snipes, who's 90 years old.
I know, I did notice that, where I was like, Wesley Snipes is quite a bit older than Nick Cannon.
And Nick Cannon was not great.
Why was he not great?
I mean, partly he's trying to come off as like some C-rate Denzel Washington in the Training Day era, and there's just no charisma to him.
No, I thought he did a great job of rapping. I thought he was sexy as fuck. And I thought that he seemed, like, given a gigantic and hard emotional arc that was sort of like steeped in realness while at the same time being so cartoonishly bizarre, he managed to stay on top of that bull for the whole time.
Have any of you guys been, like, spent a considerable amount of time in Southside Chicago?
Yes.
No.
Okay. So, Margaret, you were from there, so that would be weird if you hadn't, but I'm really proud of you for doing so. I had to go there and cover Jennifer Hudson's family murders, and I had to spend a week there. And it was the week before Obama was elected president for the first time. And it was one of the strangest experiences of my life. So anytime I see Chicago represented on screen, specifically Southside Chicago, I get emotional. So the moment that it came up and it showed the numbers and it showed just the guns forming the country, I immediately, it like struck me right here, because there is a palpable sense. First, there's a palpable sense, sorry, Margaret, when, and sorry, Chicago, it wins, that once you land in Chicago, you immediately feel that there is something going on that you don't know about, you'll never be privy to, but don't worry about it. We got it.
That's why I love it.
It's just secretly shady. But then you go to the South Side of Chicago, and I remember just like trying to do my job covering it as a reporter. And the story started out being, oh my God, Jennifer Hudson's family was murdered. What's the scoop? And it ended up becoming, this place is fucked up. There are people that are literally have been beaten so far into the ground generationally for generations that they don't know any different. On top of that, we're here intruding on them. It was probably one of the only weeks where they didn't have crime there, because there were so many cameras and media on the ground that they were annoyed that this was the attention paid. They don't like Oprah. They don't like most people. This area is like a different,
It's a different country.
It's a different country.
Like, as a white person who watches narratives about black people, I think that there is something so interesting that this one, which was trying to pull me out of safe narratives, is the one where I really sort of got the whole, where the idea that gang structures exist in places where America's legal system and justice system would just go in and start shooting and arresting anybody.
Yeah.
And so you need to rely on different structures, and then those structures become dangerous in their way.
Sure.
And there was something really neat and valuable about that. And I think that we, in our explorations of Black America, because there is this gigantic debt of guilt that white people never want to stare at, that we have these narratives that are just suffused with pathos. Whatever you want to say about Precious, like, the thing that was disgusting about Precious and also compelling about it was that it was unrelenting in what it was dumping pathos-wise on this story. It was just saying the worst, the worst.
We talk about Precious every week.
because it clearly did something.
Yeah.
But there was something so interesting about this story pulling you in and out of identification of that kind that allowed you to sort of like look at the players in a different way.
This is one of those cases where I just feel like, wow, we watch really two completely different films.
Okay.
And I had the same conversation with my wife, because she loved the film and I came away being on the opposite side of that. And we tried to talk it through during dinner time in terms of what did you like about it and what did I dislike about it. And it really, I just felt like we watched, our experience was watching two completely different films.
Can you agree that Tiana Paris was fucking,
fucking fierce
on fucking every phenomenal. Fucking moment?
Yeah, but then it kind of goes back to this critique of, so the idea here, I mean, it goes back to what you were saying before, Guy, is the only agency that women have within the story, the sexual their sexuality. And in doing so, Spike Lee hypersexualizes pretty much all of the women in the film.
But hold up a minute. That's all we're reduced to, especially in scenarios like that. We're reduced. Like, we're baby makers. We are sexual beings. We have to look good. We have to maintain you if we want to get anything accomplished in that socioeconomic environment. So, okay. Like, it wasn't...
Especially black women. It's so much about the body.
That's what I'm speaking about. Yeah. It's so much about the body. And that's what was interesting is that they had women of all shapes and sizes represented, but it was like he could have her, but it was just as easy. It didn't matter that they gave up sex. He went and got some other bitch.
Well, I mean, and that's where I feel like I'm just like, all right, what's going on now?
Yeah.
The entire attempt to take over the armory as an echo of, because like in Lys Estrada, they go and they try to steal the money from the Acropolis or from the Parthenon. And like those things I felt like didn't sync up but were weird. The last third of the movie, I was just like, really? What? Because, I mean, the whole, like, Lys Estrada, the joke at the end is the bitches want it so bad, they end up just giving up. And, like, it is fundamentally a comedy, and it is, Spike Lee couldn't make the same kind of comedy because there is a certain hopelessness.
He just goes all over the place.
Yeah.
When the older gentlemen come in, like whoever those clowns were supposed to be.
The knights of whatever.
They're supposed to be these old tacky-ass Negroes. Come and storm the armory, and then they walk away. I'm like, okay, what was the point of that?
Right.
Then the insurance dude, like, he shows up, and Angela Bassett reads him for filth, and then he disappears.
And then she disappears for the remainder
for
of the movie.
We see her in the television watching period during the showdown, but that's about it.
I do think, though, that in a way, like, all of this is about, like, the language of satire, which we're not, like, really, we're not that well trained in anymore. I think 30 years ago and prior, like, people had much more, like, satire was much more of a practiced art form. And I don't think we see it as much anymore. And one thing that satire works with a ton is hyperbole, exaggeration, complete mythological blown out figures, which is what all the women and the men are. I mean, as much as the women get, turned into just sexual beings, so do the men.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sitting there humping the air, screaming for pussy. I mean, the whole thing is absurd.
I made some pussy.
Both of them are rendered to just complete animals. And that's like part of the point is like, this is war. It reduces us to animals. In a way, it taps into the same sexual instinct that.
Lys Estrada, the character, was at all times a thinking, organizing agent who was savvy and playful and capable. But I did feel like there did come that point where he kept trying to sort of like have hugging and loving and fixing at the end. And it's not a story where you can have hugging and loving and fixing.
Well, I think he found like the temporary stopping point in his own story, which is really all you can do with a story like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, which is why he kind of throws in that last shot, which I won't say just in case that is a giveaway.
We're way beyond the spoiler points.
All right.
So
he says wake up, right? So, I mean, there's sort of this aspect of like, okay, I'm going to give you this sort of like the happy ending as much as it can be in this story, but then I'm also saying to you, wake the fuck up, you know? So, I mean, it is like wanting it both ways. I mean, look, I understand, like, the movie is a hot mess in certain moments, especially in the middle.
Yes.
Because the middle just kind of falls apart. You can't quite maintain a certain kind of stamina in it. But I have to say, like, I just think every minute of that movie was alive in a way that I have not seen in a long time.
Yes.
And honestly, I'm so sick of, like, the good director model in this era being about, like, the guy who steps in on, like, the part three of the franchise and, like, gets more shit to blow up, so he's a great director. And it's like, this movie had ideas.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them work.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them stick.
Mm-hmm.
But goddamn, there was more ideas than there have been in, like, Marvel things for the past, like, 5 years.
Well,
I'm sorry.
The weirdness of, like, David O. Russell, back when he was pulling crazy bullshit all the time, we were like, that guy's crazy. And now that he makes the same movie over and over and over again, it shows up to the Oscars every year.
Does he, like, owe his, like, poker, like, bookie or something? Because he just keeps getting employed by the same people. It's like they're all in on some, like, secret plan. But the one thing I do want to say is that the back to satire.
Yeah.
I posted this on the Pop Rocket Facebook, my favorite movie that really covers satire, but from the black perspective, and it's really focused more on entertainment as a whole, was Hollywood Shuffle, which was Robert Townsend's movie. That's, to me, as far as we're talking about, like, a black film, the last time I saw a movie that really delicately, eloquently, and really beautifully. That movie's only like 75 minutes long, but it, like, packs in all these amazing just, like, skits.
But compare that with Bamboozled, which is trying to cover the same territory, but is doing it in a Spike Lee way that is, like, intellectual and is trying to, like, heighten the terms of taking it directly to actual blackface. But is, again, a shit show, just something that doesn't hold together.
Spike. I think that's Spike.
And that was a more conventional narrative film.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's also very, it was satirical in a way that I think was more legible. I mean, I get the point that obviously Chirac is meant to be really, really satirical. I just don't think it's very successful as satire, but I get the fact that it's obviously going over the top with that.
I mean, I don't think that anyone at any point in time has watched Alyssa Strata and thought, oh, a sex strike is the answer. But I think it is possible to come away from it and realize, like, Jesus Christ, we all are participatory in the system.
Right.
The thing is, though, number one, if you need to have watched or have knowledge of the original Greek play in order to make sense of this film, that to me is a problem when it's a film that's trying to deal with something that's quite real, which is, again, like the number of dead black men in Chicago. And I think had Spike chosen to fictionalize a different kind of scenario with it, maybe it wouldn't bother me as much.
He can't do that, because the reason we're even talking about it right now on the podcast is because he did it that way. We weren't going to talk about another movie just about Negroes dying in Chicago.
I kind of agree. I think he had to have some sort of concept or gimmick to it.
See, I think that makes it... Well, go ahead, Guy.
Oh, just the degree to which, and again, I think that this was a poorly structured movie, but the way that it was splashing me in very cold water and then in very hot water over and over again, that you are going from, like, these things that felt like, you know, like verse drama to people talking about, like, real human damage that they have experienced. I did have a little, like, it's hard for you to bring up the Jennifer Hudson, like, the death of her family because
you didn't feel it.
She's not good.
Yeah.
No, she's not good.
We all agreed that.
Yeah. I mean, I think she just couldn't go there.
She can't go there. Well, she's not grieved yet. She's 100% not grieved yet.
And it is the horrible thing of, we gave her an Academy Award for singing a song really well,
right,
which she was able to sell completely.
Yes.
And all of the other work that we've asked her to do, I don't know that she's ready for.
No. If we just want to compare it, though, Guy, like, she fucking killed Effie. She
absolutely no question.
And then I'm like, this is, you have touched this. You have literally, I was there. I saw it. Like, this was brutal what she went through. And to touch on the very same scenario, and she's like, oh, is this my daughter? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, no, and I'm not like minimalizing
right.
it.
But she wasn't good. It was not a good performance.
You know what this is like, and this is your opportunity to drive this home to everybody.
And if there had been more, like, I feel like if there had been more operatic pain, which is also kind of not what Angela Bassett's giving you, because she was it was just not the character that was there. That would have been an interesting counterpoint. Let's talk about John Cusack and what that was, because John Cusack plays a minister, and I spent 10 minutes watching that movie before I understood whether he was supposed to be a parody of a presence or an actual, like, sincere, sympathetic character.
Right. And it's the latter.
Yes.
But it does take you a while to figure that out. It
takes you forever because...
I think it's all in how he gets introduced, which was the wrong way.
Yes.
He comes running up on that scene where everybody's crowding around looking at the dead little girl, and he just looks absurd because he comes running up in this, like, hippie,
it could have been anybody. It could have been John Travolta. It could have been...
It just
so
was
pasty.
All wrong.
And
yeah.
He was so pasty.
It was shocking.
And
it was just,
so pasty in a movie that I don't believe has... Or The only other,
listen, the Irish are pasty, guys. Come on, you know.
The only other white-speaking characters are representatives of the white power establishment, who are cartoonish representations of authority.
Right. You have this like daily Rahm Emanuel confluence character. Yeah.
And then he shows up in this weird hippie uniform that, like, it's not even a cross that he's wearing. It's some sort of weird peace sign-y thing. Then you go to a funeral that is strange, like, and felt like a weird parody of religion. And there's a black Jesus up, and there's one of those very sentimental, a child has died, sort of like poster board operations. But then people are dancing around in flowing white garments, and you assume in something that is a satire that something is being satirized about religion here. And then as the film goes on, you're like, no, I was supposed to be taking that straight. So if I was supposed to take it straight, why wasn't he wearing a fucking cross?
Well, the thing is that when's the last time you guys have been in like a black
church? I was just going to say, like
that's okay. Like totally like the new black church. Like that's like what
or
goes
even
down.
25 years ago. I mean, I've been to black churches on the south side.
Yeah.
Like that was part of what my dad did sometimes is like reach out to these other churches on the south side.
That was
and
like totally
that's real.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I liked about taking away from the movie real fast is that of all the people who've been in the movie, he's the one that's literally on Twitter all day, all night. His white guilt was tapped into on like some cerebral, like visceral level, because he's like tweeting out like he's always been verbal about how he's a Democrat and he's liberal, but it's gone into I follow him on Twitter. It's gone into overload. Mm. Like he has felt something.
Well, also that sermon he gives is fantastic because again, if I had watched,
was a little too Jim Baker.
I loved it. It was pretty on fire.
To me, it felt like. Like the text of a fire and brimstone, we must deal with this situation, funeral sermon that a black minister would give, but it was being delivered to me by a white guy in clothes that I didn't understand. So the whole time I was trying to parse its meaning, and it made me so much more viscerally aware of everything that was going on.
Sure.
Well, I was telling Guy right before we started that I was wondering about that character because I had this feeling watching it. I was like, I know this is based on a real guy, like just some memory of like, isn't there a Chicago like white minister who's like really active in the black community? So then I went and looked it up, and it is this guy, Michael Fleffinger. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, some Irish last name. And he has been in Inglewood for the past 40 years, and he had a foster son that was killed by gang violence, and he is deeply embedded. And I do think that in that way, I respect that character because it's like, that's a Chicago person, like, imported into this story. So that made it to me a little more credible because I was like, why do this? But then I also think that's a little sign of, like, just this sort of punk rock ethos that Spike Lee also has. Like, he's also just willing to sort of blow up what you expect from something. Like, I'm not just going to give you the black minister. I'm going to give you the white minister so that your brain is scrambled.
But he's giving you a character based on someone who's real. So if that, if that same character had been African-American, would he still have cast Cusack in that role? Probably not. He would have found a black guy.
I kind of wish he would.
I don't know what that means,
kinda
but why is that?
Yeah.
Why is that one thing or another?
I actually thought that's what he was doing. I thought he was casting Cusack as it happens all the time. Lately, I thought he was casting him in a role that would have been for a black man. And I actually respected Cusack more for it because he wasn't like pantomiming or being like coonish. He was actually
I thought his performance was actually pretty
amazing.
Good. Yeah.
But I also wonder if it's the reason why he was startling when he came up onto the screen is because are we not supposed to expect that white people care about what's happening in a predominantly, and not just predominantly, this is a fucking war zone.
Well, it was, you know what I mean? It was very interesting to have.
Like, they're not burning, like frankincense and myrrh. And like.
I mean, having white sympathy be taken seriously in this movie was such an interesting note to hit.
None of them were get out of here, honky.
Well, and also, it would be perfectly reasonable of a Spike Lee film about gun violence in Chicago to say, well, nothing you've been doing has been helping white people. And I thought that there was something really interesting and bold about hitting that note so hard.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta get this one last critique in, which is that I think what's interesting about looking at the reactions to the film is that most mainstream film critics who reviewed it, and that's predominantly white men, they really like the film. And the film's done really well in terms of you looking at the Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes scores. It's done very high. But then I was looking at all of the reviews that were written either by black activists or black cultural critics, or not film critics, but they write about culture. And again, it's an inverse. They hated the film. And I think one of the main points they brought up, which was bugging me, especially by the end of the film, is that to me, part of Chirac felt like a two-hour dramatization of what respectability politics looks like, which is the idea that this violence is predominantly carried forth because of Black cultural pathology. I mean, they actually used the phrase self-genocide, which is a phrase that I guess the real white preacher from the South Side has used. And this idea that the way in which you can stop this violence is by changing the man in the mirror, and by Nick Cannon's character having to admit to having killed, Jennifer Hudson's daughter, and then is taken to jail by the police. That this is part of the, I mean,
that
what
was
I took
so
for
weird.
It.
That like that was so weird because it was the situation where we've expressed that sort of everyone on both sides is guilty of this in some way or another, and I was expecting something far more like Truth and Reconciliation rather than the notion of like, well, culpability for you,
right.
Nick Cannon.
Right. Right. And so in the end, the message that Spike, I felt like the movie is saying is that if we're going to solve this gun violence issue, and this we're going to take us all the way back to where we started with the New York Times op-ed, the argument here is you do it by addressing the cultural pathology. And what's left largely on the wayside is any kind of discussion or real, any kind of meaningful discussion about the sort of systemic structural racism and the structure of capitalism. And again, that would have been a very different film. And Spike tries to nod to it, but he does it for like these blink of an eyes. And really the heavy weight of the film is it's all about us. We have to do it for ourselves.
At the end, there was this weird moment of, and everybody has a job now.
Yes.
That didn't make any sense.
Yes, came out of nowhere.
But I didn't think it was a movie about that. I thought that it was...
It's not a movie about gun violence?
No, I don't think it's a movie about this is how we solve gun violence across the board. I think it was an exploration of one aspect of it, which is we are society and society is us. We make small choices every day that allow systems to continue. Think about your place in the system.
I did not take that message away from the film.
I took it away from the film only because I have an emotional connection, obviously, by going and covering that story and only ever being on one side of Chicago my entire upbringing and seeing a different way of life. And now having gone there, it's forever ingrained in me. And then reading about Chicago and thinking about Chicago and thinking about how many people die and thinking about how many people died just when I was there. Like, I wasn't even there that long. And the amount of people that were shot in the face, the amount of cops that had, like, collapsed.
At this point, who here has seen Spotlight?
Not yet.
I thought it was an interesting movie to compare to Spotlight because they are essentially about cities that allow destructive systems to perpetuate.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that both of them did an interesting job of holding a mirror up to the people who were like trying to like deal with the problem. Spotlight, of course, is far more directly and rightfully so sort of like saying to the Boston Globe, you could have dealt with this earlier, but you didn't because you weren't thinking about it. And I think I compare it just for the reason that I feel like Chirac is about saying this is a world you take for granted. Like, step back from that and just think about it. You know what I mean?
I mean, I do think there is a nod to it being a systemic issue, or why have the mayor character in there? You know what I mean?
But
why have these obvious signifiers that, like, the government is stacked against them?
But it's so, to me, it was so superficial compared to the rest of the film, which is all about these characters and how they relate to each other, and all of the responsibility is ultimately put on the Spartans and on what the fuck was the other team?
The Trojans.
And Trojans, right? That they're the ones who have to make the change, and until they're willing to come to the table and to do that and to be guilted and to be moralized into it, then this will never stop. Which again, it puts the onus of responsibility on the people who are largely both the perpetrators and the victims of the violence, but without, I mean, yes, he does nod to the larger systemic quality of it, but not in the way that Spotlight does. Spotlight takes pains to say it's not enough to go after the archbishop. You have to look at the
Boston.
Larger system, right, that how the city's doing. And I really didn't come away from Chirac thinking that it indicted the city or these larger systems within it.
I thought that Chirac was a movie, essentially a for us, by us movie that I got to watch that was essentially saying, like, those are other things that will be dealt with by other movies.
A boo-boo movie?
Yes. But this movie is just about let's not prop this thing up. What the fuck was that dude who was in charge of the armory? What the fuck was that?
General King Kong, right?
No, yeah. His character. No, he as an actor, he was the one from Warriors, right? He's much more older than.
I don't know.
Yes, 100%. I forgot his name, but Spike Lee is in love with him. He's in like he's been in like at least three or four. He was in like Summer of Sam. He was from the Warriors.
Anyone okay. have remotely a theory about why that was there?
I don't know. White people are racist.
I think it was just like ribald and raunchy and ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah. And like, let's see this man ride a cannon in Confederacy underwear. Yeah.
But you guys, She's Gotta Have It. Like, it reminded me of She's Gotta Have It a lot. Because She's Gotta Have It is like also one of those movies where it's just the indictment is all on her. Like, she's not allowed to be sexually, she's not allowed to be promiscuous or mm-hmm. make decisions about who she's going to sleep with and when. She has the audacity and the balls to invite all of the men to dinner, and then they sit up there and then one like takes her and to show his power, she's like, let me just let him take me. Like, it was like one of those scenarios where it's always like it's always up to us to figure out what's going to get solved.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing that I think is key about that scene is that it shows that a black woman is able to come into this white space, and the white guy allows her to be there because she's sexy. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? He's down with the brown sugar. He will kill her mate, but he's down with her because she's hot and sexy. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like the hypocrisy that lives within like white supremacy. Like,
But more people out there need to do stuff with Tiana Paris, because
oh, she's amazing.
That woman's gorgeous and was so great and so funny. I was a big fan. Oliver, you spoke critically of this movie as a representation of Chicago, and I wanted your thoughts. I've heard a lot of criticisms that Spike Lee doesn't get the feel of Chicago, and I wanted you to talk about that, and then Margaret
I'm not from Chicago. I have no idea how the city, whether the city is accurately portrayed or not.
But you said that in the email, didn't you?
Did I?
Oh, you did.
I don't.
Oh, I thought you said he has no feel for Chicago.
No, that wasn't me. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
My bad.
Never mind.
Maybe someone else said that. That wasn't me.
Well, what I thought was interesting about it is that this first scene where they show the Damon subway sign or L sign is actually not in the South Side at all.
Yeah.
That's in Wicker Park.
Uh-huh.
Which is like
I know that.
Yeah, you can't get more sort of like white hipsterville than Wicker Park.
Yeah.
And that was whack.
So that was kind of a weird choice, but I also was kind of like, again, like Spike Lee is just scrambling all this stuff up. But then a couple scenes later, you see the 64th Street sign. You see the way that the buildings look, which is very like true to the South Side, and the grass being overgrown and like empty lots being next to, you know, these gray stones that aren't very well taken care of. And I do know that he actually filmed in the area and was there for a few months. And
I'm curious as to what the process, I would love to know what his process was like, because how did he, was he able to be there to talk about this shit and no one got hurt?
Well, I was reading this interview that Paris did with Vogue.com, and she was talking about how many people would walk up to them during the filming and just thank them for even filming anything down there.
Wow.
Because that doesn't happen. You know, yeah. People do film in Chicago, but they're not touching Inglewood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it did have some real concrete flavor to my mind, but it wasn't like, you know, it also to me felt like, I really did think, would Spike have made this movie about New York? Because New York is to him this like individual home. It's his place. And
yeah.
I did feel like he was able to project this vision on Chicago because he doesn't really know it.
Mm.
So it's cartoon land a little bit for him.
About the filming process, just my favorite Spike Lee story is when they made Crooklyn, they like took the children out onto the street to like play on the street and play like street games. And all of the little children of Brooklyn of 1990, whatever, were like, we're not allowed to play on the street because we would get shot. So we don't know. You're going to have to teach us how to play hopscotch. And I thought that was adorable. And I love Crooklyn a lot. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to tell you what our jams are after this.
Hello, buddies. I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Andy Bolt.
And we're the host of Bunker Buddies. We're a podcast where we're amateur survivalists, and we talk about things like the apocalypse.
And we talk about zombies and preparedness.
What are you going to wear when it's the apocalypse?
And you have no idea if you don't listen to our show. It comes out every Wednesdays on MaximumFun.org and on iTunes. Sometimes we try weird foods, or we talk about where to camp, or how to avoid getting eaten, or any of these things.
Yeah, so listen to us, because it might just save your life.
We'll see you in the bunker.
Bye!
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang.
And normally this would be the time when we tell you our jam. We're going to do that in just a moment, but Oliver has first suggested we go around and answer a little question. What's that question, Oliver?
Lightning round, favorite Spike Lee movies.
For me, it's, as I already said, Crooklyn. It is so warm and so lovely. And just a place and a time. It's giving you a little girl growing up in Brooklyn in the 70s. And it is so honest. Like, it is so emotionally honest. I couldn't love it more. With an honorable mention to School Days, which I saw as, like, a young teen. And it was electric and exciting and laid the groundwork for my understanding of Black female hair politics, which is important for every gay man to understand. Winner, what about you?
It's so many. I don't know where to begin, but really fast, and I'm not going to go into detail because if you know me by this point, you know why I like them. She's Got to Have It, School Days, Summer of Sam, The 25th Hour is one of my personal favorites. I really like, what's the one he did with, oh, He Got Game. I love that movie. And then just going down through one more, I'm just got to remember what it is. Oh, and then honorable mention to the fact that he directed Bad by Michael Jackson.
Margaret, what about you?
Do the Right Thing. Can't slam on that. I also love Malcolm X. It's just such a force to be reckoned with.
Uh-huh.
Summer of Sam, too. Like, I mean, this has so much.
Like, I didn't even think of Malcolm X, but what a fucking watchable movie.
Yes,
Malcolm
it
is X
three
is.
And a half fucking hours.
Three and a half hours long. But it's always weird when there's something that is this, like, intense emotional movie, and you're like, I've said it before, I'll say it again. There's not a moment in my life when I couldn't watch The Color Purple. And that's a movie that you should not just be watching on a Saturday afternoon for no
unless
reason.
Unless you want no weekend left.
Right. But the thing is like, you know, that, your Gandhi, your Malcolm X, they're just good movies, Oliver.
So
Wait.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Clockers.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Interesting.
That was the best dolly shot use when the kid's on the bicycle and Karis One's playing in the background.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's we forgot to mention about Chirac is that you get not one dolly shot, but two dolly shots, which for the Spike Lee dolly shot fan, that's like double the pleasure right there. My number one's Malcolm X for all the reasons that people laid out. I don't know why it is, and probably because, you know, it's Hollywood and racism, but how it is that we never managed to get another film where Denzel and Angela Bassett were playing leads with one another.
Angela Bassett, not nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Not nominated.
And Denzel not winning for Best Actor
yeah.
for that year. Travesties. Honorable mention goes to Inside Man because I thought it was, to me, that's the most watchable Spike Lee film, even though it's basically a genre heist film, but I thought it was executed really well, but still felt very Spike Lee-ish.
Mm-hmm. All right.
One day I have to tell a story about Inside Man because I worked for his agent at that time.
Let's make that today.
Another day for another time.
Off mic.
All right.
Off mic.
Well, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask a question. It is, what is your current jam? Yes, Oliver. Would you like to go first?
I do.
Oliver, go first.
Because
what's
one
your
of the
jam?
The reason why is because one of the few things I really did love about Chirac was a scene in which they play the Shy Lights, Oh Girl, where the group of women are singing the one verse and a group of men are singing one verse. And it was like a little mini music video. And I loved it because it's playing Shy Lights, Oh Girl. And let's listen to this 1972 classic.
The Shy Light song's gonna get me to drop the panties.
Yeah, right. You gotta go deeper than that.
You gotta go deeper than that, boo boo. Nice, but no salami.
Oh.
That's what this is.
Yeah.
Unofficially, no quadrants. No quadrants.
Really? Wow. All right, Winner, what's your current jam?
Someone Great by LCD Sound System, because I heard they were getting back together and I've been listening to them lately. And I was watching The Affair last week, which The Affair is getting on Showtime more and more ridiculous by every week. But what's the song? You know, Margaret, North Americans.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that the name of the song?
North Americans.
There's another. Okay, they were playing that during a party in 2015, which was kind of cute. But this song, I just started listening to it again because I was going through my LCD sound system faves. And this song is just 6 minutes and 30 seconds of just like totally questioning anything that's going on in your life
right now.
I'm going
to have to rip these egg crates right off this wall.
You agree?
Yeah. I love LCD.
Thank you. I love it.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen them in concert?
No, but I want to.
Okay, if they do get back together.
We're going together.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I've seen them a lot of times. No, and it is fucking great every time.
I put this into a mixtape.
Is this pre or post 9/11? Because I distinctly remember this post 9/11 being like... I don't know. I just love this song. It was coming up in time.
Mm. This week, I talked about music last week for our holiday music special, and that's all I've really been listening to in the past week is holiday music.
Really? What's been on the main spin?
I mean, it's been the usual suspects that we discussed before, but Jen, one of our listeners, Jen, went to like a mall that had like coordinated music and like lights going on. And she took a video and like posted it to Twitter so I could see it because they played Barbara's Jingle Bells.
But
because it is such a frenetic song, it was like this mall was just going crazy. And it was
That's adorable.
High level work
epileptic attack
from the Rocketeers. Margaret, what is your current jam?
Well, last night, Winter and I, after seeing Chirac, somehow Erykah Badu came up, and I just started thinking, oh shit, she's got a new album, and I haven't really gone and checked it out. So I listened to it today, and it's all songs based around the phone. And a lot of them are covers, or at least parts of covers.
Remakes.
Yeah, remakes. And like, you know, for instance, she takes Hotline Bling and sort of twists that around. And she also has a duet at the end of the album with Andre 3000, who, you know, together they had a love child. Exactly. And so the album's called But You Can't Use My Phone. And this song is one of the covers on it of New Edition's Mr. Telephone Man. I love how just like smoky and blurry she made this song. You know, like the original is like kind of a bright chipper thing, and she put all of this sort of these layers on it, and it ends in this really kind of shockingly beautiful way where it like ends with this piano. It's great.
Can we give her a shout out, because she's like that aunt that you never see, that you always wonder what's going
on. She's a recluse,
and then she comes out and tells you thousands of stories that are all entertaining. You never want it to end, and then her trip is over, and then she's bounced.
And she's an artiste.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I love the shit out of her.
But it's the difficult thing if she's always in second gear. She's never not in second gear.
Oh, I disagree.
Since that first album. I don't mean quality-wise. Okay. I just mean energy-wise, that she's always...
Chill?
She's always chill, and she's always giving you...
She's had a lot of babies.
Mood songs. Yeah. But it's also... As a feminist, what I want is for ladies to be able to make babies and still be cranking out art left and right. And the thing is she's clearly making the art that she wants to make.
Yeah.
And so more power to her.
Real quick, shout out to Emily Lordy at UMass Amherst, who wrote a really good analysis of that new Erykah Badu mixtape / album. It's Lordy with an I at the end, so Google it and you can track it down.
Oh, cool.
All right, you guys. You've been listening to Pop Rocket with me, Guy Branum, with... Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We will post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Rachel Eliz 1234, MPPPEF5, and WFTV for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Come on, you guys. We had that period of time where we're getting a lot of reviews, and now it's slowed down. And I don't know what's wrong.
Is up.
We've been making some
holidays. Did we do something wrong? Did we say something?
Guy is back. He's here. He's
we've been
present.
Making amazing shows for you guys. I don't know if you listened to that holiday music roundup, but we were pretty much firing on all five cylinders.
And can we preview next week's show?
Yes.
Which is episode 50.
Oh,
episode
yeah.
We've been doing this for
yeah,
50
guys.
Freaking episodes.
On next week's episode, we decided that in honor of our 50th episode, we would go back 50 years in time, and we will talk about our favorite pop culture of 1965, our favorite jams, everything. So get ready for it. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us what songs you always skip on an album you otherwise love. And we're going to need a question for the top of the show about 1965. So please, throw down with one. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. And our producers are the delightful, charming, and very young Christian Duenas, the continually absent, because he's off in England, having a family, and doing professional things, Colin Anderson, and Baroness Perello is usually on here, and he's probably going to cut it together, but he isn't today, and I don't know why not. Thanks for listening.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.